It's a special edition of Wrestling Observer Radio. I'm Jim Valley with Dave Meltzer. Joining us today is Marshall Zalaznik, the CEO of Glory Kickboxing. We'll talk about the sport and two shows in Chicago this weekend and a huge card next month in Holland. But Marshall has also been with UFC and Major League Gaming, and he's really experienced with opening up new markets, streaming, and other aspects.
Yeah, I mean, not just kickboxing, but really, I'd like to talk to Marshall since he's got hands-on experience in what I would call the changing landscape of, you know, combat sports, and it relates to wrestling and everything, because Marshall's background, he was one of the top guys within demand, went to UFC, spent years, you know, developed the UK market, the Australia market, was one of the top executives there, and launched Fight Pass, was the guy put in charge of Fight Pass when it first came out. So he was there for the pay-per-view era, for the beginning of the streaming era, and we're now in the middle of this era. We've got pay-per-view is still existing. It's changing people's mind. You know, you get different reactions from people when it comes to pay-per-view because of DAZN and because of streaming services. And really, we're in a transitional period with the landscape. And now with Glory, Marshall is in a position of being the head of a company with a, you know, very similar in some ways, where you could say similar but different to UFC, in the sense it's a very exciting combat sport. But, you know, it was, you know, UFC in certainly in the UK when you started, but you know, in the United States pre-2005, you know, UFC was largely underground. It had a loyal fan base, but, you know, and kickboxing certainly has its fan base, but it's not mainstream in this country. And obviously that's, you know, the goal. The goal is to, you know, whatever made UFC click, make it click for kickboxing, you know, develop the personalities and everything. So after that long introduction, there's just like a lot of different topics to talk about. So I guess first, you know, what's your thoughts on just the whole scenario right now?
Yeah, well, first of all, thanks for that introduction. It was it's great. Sometimes when you get on from role to role, you never have a chance to look back with any perspective. But yeah, you've identified pretty clearly some of the roles that I had and how I'm now in this new role at Glory, which has been, you know, almost 2 years now. I guess it's not that new, is how all of those sort of learnings are helping me navigate now. And so as a frankly challenger sports property in the U.S., you know, trying to grow our business and engage a bigger audience, you know, we're confronted with the macro environment of what's happening in media. And I remember back in the day when I was at In Demand and UFC was, you know, limping along on pay-per-view. And to your point, there was a really loyal, hardcore following. And Dana tells the story about launching The Ultimate Fighter. What really helped propel the UFC was getting that broad pay television distribution with a product like The Ultimate Fighter and then exposing more fights to more people. And the megaphone of the day was these broadly distributed pay channels or free channels, and the feeling always was, I remember back at the UFC, the hope was, I'm sorry, back at In Demand, if UFC could find that megaphone, that the product was so good that people would come to it, and that sort of bared itself out to be true. You know, then moving ahead now to where Glory is in the U.S., the environment has totally changed. You know, no longer is it the case that you can put your really great content on a strong linear network and think that you're just going to automatically grow your business. It's a fragmented viewership. Social media wasn't really a thing when we were launching, you know, back the UFC internationally. So as someone in my position now trying to engage this fan base, we've got to be really creative and smart, frankly, about how we distribute our content, because there are more and more paywalls, ESPN Plus, Fight Pass, DAZN, WWE Network. You got to pay to watch, not dissimilar to pay-per-view, although the offering is better in the subscription world. But it doesn't reach 110 million potential TV households like you used to when you got to deal with Spike TV or got to deal with Fox. So for a group like ours, it's critical that we make sure that we fish where the fish are. So our deal with Fight Pass is very important to us. It helps us to reach a fight audience who's got knowledge of the stand-up part of, say, MMA, because ultimately what Glory is, it's basically the stand-up part of MMA, and we will refer to it as kickboxing. We also refer to it as stand-up combat because it's just got the stand-up element. It's got knees and kicks. They fight with gloves, and it's in a ring. But they're very short fights. They're 3 rounds and 5 rounds for a championship, very familiar to the MMA fan. And so our distribution strategy was make sure we're feeding that audience, and we think UFC does a great job of getting us access to that audience, and then preserving all of the other rights that we can utilize, things like Snap and Facebook and YouTube and Twitter and our social feed, to make sure that we're engaging with, whether it's short clips or longer form storytelling, to try to expand our fan base. And that's the trick now. It used to literally be, if you could get that strong linear deal, you were basically on your way, so as long as your product was good. It didn't guarantee success. But now it's much more challenging in the current environment.
Yeah, I mean, I've noticed that, like, with wrestling startups, like we just had AEW startup on television, and they're doing very well, but it wasn't like they just did their first pay-per-view since television and did essentially similar numbers to their pay-per-views without television, whereas as you will remember, when UFC didn't have television, they were limping along with a hardcore fan base that would buy the few shows a year that they did, and then as soon as they got on television, you know, those numbers exploded because of the exposure of television. And now, right. I think the lesson of this year, to me, with AEW, is that just getting, and it's good television, it's prime time, 2 hours on a Wednesday night on TNT, you know, I mean, it's fantastic television, that just being on television is not, you know, UFC had, when they started, it was 11 o'clock on a Monday night, which did benefit because a lot of wrestling fans were watching Raw up until that point, but it's 11 o'clock on a Monday night on a weaker channel, and they exploded off of that. And now, on a better channel with a better time slot, the movement isn't there because, you know, the power of television is not the same, and there's, like you said, it's a fragmented, it's the whole environment's very, it's hard. It's like it's easier if you're at a low level to get attention because of social media, but it's harder to explode. Would you think that that's kind of like the fair way to put it?
I think so, yeah. I think this is a long play now. Obviously, you know, Dana and the Fertittas, you know, were at this a while, and, you know, through their real labor of love, they were able to make something happen there, but it took some time. And I do think this is a bit of a time game. I also honestly worry about, you know, where the audience will be and how best to engage them. You know, part of this rush to streaming, and I don't mean that in a negative way, but, you know, with Netflix, you know, having this massive impact, and Amazon Prime, that, you know, my son is a teenager, that's all they do. They're only on these SVOD products, and they are not channel surfing the way I did to stumble across something. And the only way that anything gets in front of them is it has to come across their social channel, and then maybe it'll, but that's, you know, 15 seconds. You know, it's not, hey, I stumbled on something, I'm going to watch this for 10 minutes until the next commercial break. Hey, I like it. So it creates a real challenge, and your ability to maintain enough pace of content to keep pounding the drum so that people finally hear it is the real challenge. I think that you know, when you think about products like, you know, Glory, we're in this boat as well. You know, you've done a deal, you're on an OTT product that is a subscription product. It's how do you get out beyond your current subscriber base? And if you look at WWE Network, which I used to really be, you know, focused on, you know, as we launched Fight Pass, or we had launched Fight Pass, and we're sort of watching their numbers, and you look at their subscribers, you know, they're in this band now, and they're not, the subscriber base doesn't seem to be really growing, at least as they're in their quarterly reports. I have no idea what their unique buyers are doing in terms of how much that's increasing or not, but you're talking to the converted. And I think what AEW probably has does is the fans that are watching it are wrestling fans. They know exactly what they're doing. They're going there for that. But is it on, you know, on TNT? Are they bringing in new fans that, as you're saying, will convert to pay-per-view? And so for me, if I'm going to be a good partner for someone like Fight Pass, it's really critical for me to do everything I can outside of the Fight Pass environment to grow the audience to make sure they move there. And I think that's what AEW is doing. And it's great. You know, everyone would love to have a slot on TNT like that. But there's more to it these days, as we were saying, than just getting that free TV deal. There has got to be a lot of energy put in to reaching all of these social channels with the, you know, with how quickly TikTok is growing and how quickly the users on all of these services grow. You have got to be really on your toes to make sure you're exploiting all of those and having enough content to do it. You know, in the old, sorry to drag on here a little bit, but in the old television media world, you would do a deal to license your product to a network, and they would more or less take all the rights, and you couldn't do anything. And if you look around, there are certain properties where the television media group owns all the content rights. They're the ones that have the tasty highlights, and they're doing it to support their network, but it takes a lot of the power away from the challenger sports property or the sports property itself in terms of what it can do to speak to its audience. And so you have to be really on top of your game in these rights negotiations to maintain enough clip rights, if you will, and other delay rights and things to make sure that you can be part of the conversation on all those other platforms. Otherwise, you do a deal, you cash your check, and you're going to wake up in 2 years and your business will not have grown.
You know, one thing, again, coming from pay-per-view, and obviously before television rights fees exploded, pay-per-view pretty much carried the UFC business during its period of growth, is it's been kind of a slow thing, and it's been, you know, following it close. It's like, to me, like there's sort of a death of pay-per-view, and I don't know, and death is too strong of a word, but certainly the streaming services have created a generation of people whose aversion to the price of pay-per-view is something that wasn't there, I would say, even 4 or 5 years ago. It's been a big change to where, you know, before it was just one of those things where you want to see the premium event, you're going to pay $40, $50, even $100 for it. That's just how it is, and everyone accepted it, and sometimes people grumbled about the price, but they watched. And now, because of the streaming, you know, with DAZN pretty much starting to cannibalize the boxing, WWE doing it on their own, they were the kind of the first ones who did it, pulled their main, basically downgraded their pay-per-view and put everything on their streaming service and made the pay-per-view price exorbitant to their fan base and to everyone's fan base in wrestling. And then UFC's kept their price, but then they moved everything to streaming and away from television because they got a great deal from ESPN Plus to do so. So it's kind of like the television pay-per-view industry is, it's like, it didn't feel to me even 2 years ago like it's dying yet, you know, especially with kind of the numbers like the Mayweather-McGregor did at $100. You know, you're going like, how is this dying? But yet, it kind of is.
Yeah, I hate to agree with you because I really cut my teeth in this business and I have a lot of friends in the pay-per-view business. And while I do think, you know, for the most part, you're right, it feels like it's dying. I think that if the right event came along and it was on pay-per-view, the pay-per-view business, to your point about Mayweather and McGregor, would actually pop. The problem now is, as you look down the road, you don't see those big events having the ability to be on pay-per-view. You've got the Matchroom, DAZN hookup. You've got UFC and everything on ESPN. I believe that in some ways, and we saw a little bit of this with Fight Pass, you know, in terms of sort of the usage. Without telling any real secrets here, you know, some people use the product as a subscription product. They stay in every month, month in and month out, and others use it like a pay-per-view product. And I think that with the DAZN property, with some of the big fights they're able to deliver, are people staying in? I have no idea what their churn rates are, but are people using that as pay-per-view, but it's masked in an SVOD product? So maybe to that extent, pay-per-view isn't dead if people are using the product the way I'm, where I my suspicion is they may be. The same may be true for ESPN. You know, obviously to buy the pay-per-view for UFC, you've got to subscribe, so you have a barrier to subscribe, and then you've got to pay more to get to the pay-per-view, or, you know, pay the same price as if you were already a subscriber. But I think the trick there is because the ESPN product overall, you know, first of all, there's a wide offering. You get effectively every UFC event. It probably has lower churn rates, and people aren't using that as a pay-per-view product as much as, say, they might be with DAZN. And of course, you mentioned the pricing, which to me is critical as well, because pay-per-view always had this sort of high price point. It was premium. You weren't going to be served advertising in it. That was always the rule. We kept it in demand. We wouldn't let advertising in there. Maybe you'd have some digital insertions. But now if you're subscribing to one of these SVOD products, you're also getting commercials in there. And so it's just the nature of pay-per-view is changing in habits, in sort of the quality experience. You know, are people still throwing massive parties when there's a big UFC or a big boxing event or a big WWE event? Or is this becoming more of a singular experience because people are watching on their phone or their tablet and haven't quite figured out how to launch app on their TV? I don't know what that usage is, but there's definitely a cultural change happening. And my kid, I'm sure, doesn't even know what PPV is. If I asked him what that acronym was, he would not know what that is. But I sure did at his age.
Yeah. You know, about Glory that you're doing, you've got shows on Friday and Saturday in Chicago, and then you got a real big show December 21st in Amsterdam with Bada Hari and Rico Verhoeven, which is kind of like the... it's the dream match of heavyweight kickboxing. They had a match a couple years ago, and Bada Hari ended up with a broken arm in the match, it had an injury conclusion, and it was a final conclusion, but it still left questions, what if he didn't get hurt, type of a thing. And it's interesting to me because, you know, I remember her, you know, Bada Hari from the ending days of when K-1 was big in Japan, and he was kind of like the rising bad boy. And Rico didn't really... I don't remember Rico in Japan. I remember learning about Rico after Japan. But Rico is... to me, he's like an interesting character because he's like... big and like this big guy, huge guy who's in fantastic shape, who's fantastically skilled. You know, it's almost like I would watch him and go, why, you know, if people knew about this guy, I mean, he would be a superstar because it's like, what was he, like 6'5", 260, but like it's not like, he's not like a lumbering heavyweight in any way, shape, or form. He's like an incredible athlete and skilled kickboxer and just an awesome fighter, really.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. Certainly, Rico's the real deal. You know, he is far and away, you know, the most dominant stand-up fighter over the last 5 or 10 years. Bada Hari, as you mentioned, did fight in K-1. He was a bit like a Vitor Belfort in that he was a bit of a phenom. He came in as a teenager and started competing and started winning. And, you know, he's now in his young 30s, and Rico's in his, you know, mid to late 20s. So they're coming together at a good time, and of course the rematch. But for us as a promotion, where we have amazing traction in Western Europe, where we have, you know, very large revenue deals from networks, we have tons of media coverage. To your point is, you know, how do we get people here in the U.S. who love MMA, they love boxing, how do we get them to shake any of what they perceive as kickboxing, which, you know, to my generation, you know, I'm over 50 now, but were people in gis sort of point fighting on ESPN, but to, you know, the younger generation, they may think of it as a fitness product, but it's one of the reason that we also, you know, call it stand-up combat, because, you know, an MMA event is either a stand-up fight or it's a ground fight. And so we use stand up to make sure that all the MMA fans know what this is. And we do think with the right exposure and the right promotion and taking opportunities like this, you know, which I again thank you for, to try to get this message out, is important, because people, if they watch it, will see it and they'll appreciate it, because I know they appreciate the fight business. And having been part of UFC's growth internationally, there are some markets that don't yet fully understand the wrestling and the jiu-jitsu part, and they do love the stand-up part. So we really think we have an opportunity to make an impact, but it's really going to require a lot of work and getting people to sample. And our event this weekend in Chicago, which of course will be on Fight Pass here in the U.S., is on Friday and Saturday. Chicago's been a great market for us, but in the fight, we've got a woman, Anissa Mexen, a French fighter, who's going for her 100th win in this sport. And she's fighting Tiffany Van Soest, who's an American. This is the third time they're fighting, and while Tiffany has lost the last two fights, she's the first person who will come back and want to fight Anissa, while other women within the division aren't in any rush to really get to Anissa. And so Tiffany's got something to prove. She's a very dynamic fighter and had a split decision loss the last time, so she's coming after her. So that's exciting. And then we have one of our Thai fighters, a guy named Patch Katmunkow, who is going for his for something like 160th win. These are the guys that have been fighting since they're 8 years old in Thailand. And he's fighting an American, Kevin Vanestrand, and that's an amazing fight. These are two of the most skilled fighters in the world at stand-up, and if people were to tune in and watch it, I think they would see why we're so bullish on this product and why we're proud to say and assert that these are the best fighters in the world, and if anyone steps in this ring under our rules, they will get beat. We've got a guy like Alex Pereira who's fighting on that December 21st card. He's beaten Adesanya twice. You know, he's beaten the UFC champion twice. He's knocked him out once. He is knocking people out. He's now a two division belt holder for us in Glory. He's defending his middleweight belt. These are like amazing athletes who I really believe that the American audience, if we can just get them to sample it and come in and check it out, I think they'd be impressed. And then to learn about these fighters, hopefully we keep them as fans and we grow from there.
You know, one of the things when you you know, you kind of like bring this up, it's what's fascinating to me. I think what the Holland show is, and I have like 32,000 tickets sold at a soccer stadium, something like that, right?
Yeah, it's incredible. It's true.
So it's what's always fascinates me is you'll have a product that, you know, obviously if you're selling 32,000 tickets to a show and we're way more than a month out, you know, it's obviously mainstream. You know, in that place, it's a big deal there. You know, you're established there, and that will always tell me that there is the potential. But you know, it's like, you know, it's like just with UFC, when you were, you know, you were in charge of going into these different markets, some markets embraced it day one. I think like Australia, as I recall, the first show in Australia, the first show in Mexico, places like that, it was you know, obviously Brazil, it was through the roof. But in other places, it was very difficult culturally. You know, places didn't want you because of the stigmas, you know, or just people, whatever it was, different ideas of fights, I don't know. But the thing with kickboxing that you don't have to deal with, that you did have to deal with UFC, was UFC came in with this rep that both helped and hurt it, in the sense of, you know, you would come into a market like whether it was Germany or whatever, and many of these markets, as you know, you were on the front lines, where you would come into town and the public and the media was like, how can this stuff exist? And with kickboxing, I don't think you really have that, but it also means that you get less attention going because you don't have that that outrage from people that have no clue what it is but decided to be outraged because people punch on the ground or whatever, you know, whatever it is, or it's a legalized street fight or whatever the terms were first time in these markets before people kind of calmed down and saw it's just a sport, you know, it's a fighting sport.
Yeah, no, you nailed it. You know, there's two macro, I don't know, maybe I'm not using that exactly right, maybe one's micro, but we talked one about the media business being so different. But you're right, UFC had this, it was a bit notorious in some markets. It was so unique that even if there were groups out there that weren't sure they wanted to, say, broadcast it, they at least wanted to learn about it, because it was so unique. Whereas kickboxing in this stand-up world we're in now has years and years, you know, tens of years, hundreds of years in Asia where this is happening. There are federations all over the world that have been managing amateur level kickboxing forever, and it's very prominent in Western Europe. And so this is sort of like just an understood product. They know exactly what it is, and it doesn't have that sort of notorious spectacle that maybe UFC had in the beginning. And you're right, it cut both ways, because on one hand, it was generally easy to get attention. Sometimes the attention wasn't positive, but it also resulted in us having, you know, being kicked off of television in Germany, having at the time not been licensed to have an event in France. There were just some cultural reactions to people fighting in a cage and punching someone when they're on the ground that we had to overcome. And I remember in those early days in Germany, in the political fight, we were there at the UFC, I remember saying to Dana at one point, like, man, now I know what it must have been like for you in the UFC before I ever got involved with the UFC, in terms of that early fight with McCain and some of the stuff that I know wasn't under the Dana watch, but still had to get, he had to confront all of that, and I had real respect for that fight. And it was a chip we carried on our shoulder at the UFC, that we were doing something unique, that this wasn't just, you know, violence for the sake of violence and brutality, and we had a real mission. And with kickboxing, because there are all these generations of people who have practiced it, who understand it, in one way the ecosystem is so good for us, because it means there are these great fighters coming in from early on, coming in to kickboxing and into Glory, that it actually helps us in a lot of these markets where MMA maybe isn't getting full traction, where we walk in and people say, ah, I know exactly what this is. Oh, you're the best. You've got the best fighters. You make the best fight the best. We're interested. And so we're able to get media deals in markets, you know, for revenue that, you know, if I look back to some of the early, you know, challenges we had with the UFC, I'm blown away by the response that we have. But the U.S. is a critical market for us. We need to be bigger and stronger here, and that's why we're putting the events on that we do in the U.S., why Fight Pass is important for us, because we do have to educate about what this property is in a different way than we had to educate about what MMA was.
You know, one thing, because I was a kid growing up here, or actually a young adult, as a kid, we kickboxing sort of existed, and then we had, like, you know, the ESPN stuff that, yeah, I would remember that really didn't interest me, you know, but luckily, living in San Jose, we had the original Strikeforce, not the MMA promotion, but it was Scott Coker's promotion that was a kickboxing promotion,
right?
And they were on ESPN as well. And so I would go to the live events because Kung Lee was a real big deal in the local market, and it was just a fun night out, and friends would go and everything. And it was pretty popular, drew pretty well. And what I remember about, you know, these really long shows, because essentially his shows would be tapings for ESPN that they would put on whenever. It would be edited into one-hour form. You know, he would probably tape 5-6 hours in a night. You know, sometimes the shows would go till 2 and 3 a.m. because they just had so many fights. And it was essentially to fill television time. But what I remember about the kickboxing, my thought on kickboxing was at, because of the nature, I guess, of kickboxing, that when people are beginners and not good at it, it looks really sloppy. But the best, yeah, when you have the best against the best, it's like, it's really incredible. It's like boxing in a lot of ways, you know, in that sense. You know, where if you see, like, two super skilled boxers and they're aggressive and everything. There's, you know, there's nothing like that kind of a boxing match. And then I said the same for kickboxing, you know. And again, I was also a big fan in the K1 days. You know, I was a big fan of K1. It was one of my great regrets. I never saw World Grand Prix live, but I thought it would, you know, go on forever and someday I would go, and then it didn't, then it ended. But like with K1, I thought K1, you know, especially because it was a heavyweight dominated sport early, and then they brought the smaller guys in later, but they were able to, you know, just capture the imagination of the public with, and those guys became, in their era, larger than life stars. And that's what I saw when I saw Rico. Was like, God, if Rico was around in that K1 era, you know, he'd have been, I mean, as big as anyone, I think, because I think he's a bigger and better fighter, and I think he's, you know, and again, you know, like in all sports, they improve. So it's kind of like, I see when I watch that high level of kickboxing that it's like, you know, like you'll watch some things and you just, like, I was always a big fan of non-traditional sports. And some of them you look and you kind of go like, nah. You know, it's never going to have mainstream appeal. It's just too boring. It's not going to capture the public. And then you'll see something like I saw with early UFC and with kickboxing, where it's just like, if the guys got over, the sport itself is actually very exciting. And, right. You know, that's kind of like, you know, when you have the best, the most skilled, it's really such a high skilled and very dangerous and explosive sport because of the ability to use your fists and your feet at such a high level, both, to me, always made it more exciting than boxing because of the different elements.
Yeah, I think you nailed it. I think that there is something to, you know, the one thing that the UFC, what we were able to do back in the day was be able to assert that while boxing had all these different belts and different weight classes and the best weren't fighting the best, you were able to represent to the world that, you know, those three letters, the UFC, ensured that you were getting the best fighters in this sport fighting each other and no one was being protected type of thing. We wanted to see who the best was. Glory is in that same spot. So we've got far and away the deepest roster of stand-up fighters, combat fighters. There's not really a competitor to us. So we've got the best fighters who fight the best month in and month out in our events. We do about 12 to 14 events a year, depending on the year. And you will see the best fighting the best. Of course, there are ranks within Glory, and there are other fighters who are elevating themselves in the ranks. And the level of fighters, you know, from fighter to fighter will change. But effectively, you are seeing the best fighting the best at their class. And the sloppiness that you speak of, obviously, you know, you can't guarantee anything, but we do our best to make sure that doesn't happen. We have basically similar rules to K1, so there's no real grappling. There's no clinching, only with the exception for clinching to strike, so you can't continue to hold a clinch and be inactive. So the referees are very quick to break fighters up. And so it just creates for a really exciting fighting style. And just to highlight your point, so when you have the best in the world fighting at under a set of rules that ensures action, you, guess what, get action. And there's a lot on the line for these fighters. There's stakes to them winning, and they know it in terms of ranking and positioning for titles. And yeah, so we're proud of that. We're proud of the fact that we've got these really amazing high level fighters. And if you watch Rico and Bader, or you watch the fights this weekend in Chicago, you will see the best fighters in their genre of fighting in the world, and can beat anyone else that steps in the ring under those rules. So it is something to behold when it's really great, just like in MMA and just like boxing. Sometimes you get two high caliber guys or women going at it, and you really appreciate it, especially a fight fan.
You know, the other thing is, as far as like the time limit aspect, when, you know, I guess because of the influence of boxing, that in the old days of the kickboxing, you know, you would have your, you know, I remember watching 12 round fights, you know, and then when K1 came and you had the 3-3 minute round fights, it was like a completely, you know, unless you're a fighter, or you learn the fight game, you don't realize what a huge difference that is, because in a 12-round fight, you know, it's all about experience and pacing, because right. you know you want out. It's a game of exhaustion, in a sense. In a 3-3 minute fight, it's a game of action, because you've got to get it done quickly, and it's way more exciting. But there's that, you know, I think that that's like a real interesting aspect of it, in the sense that you don't have tedious fights, because they don't have time to be tedious, because they're, you know, so that's also a big plus as far as the excitement goes. You know, in the modern era of kickboxing, as compared to maybe when you watched it on ESPN and you watched those 12-round fights that were, I don't want to say they were bad, because I saw some great 12-round fights in that era, but they're much slower paced than these 3-round fights.
Right. Yeah, no doubt about it. I mean, obviously the unified rules of MMA helped also to educate an audience about this notion of 3 rounds and 5-round fights and quick action. And for sure, what the shorter fights and the 3-minute rounds ensures that these fighters don't have the time to pace themselves and figure a fighter out in the first half of a 12-round fight or the first third, and then just sort of put the wood to someone else. You know, now these guys have to come out. There's no time for feeling out, and they've got to get to work. The other thing we do, and depending on the commission, but certainly international, is we broadcast the judges' scoring during the event. So between rounds, you'll know exactly how the judges are scoring it, and the corners can see it as well. And so if you're a fighter going into the last round and you need to knock a guy down or knock a guy out, you know it. And you see these fighters acting now that they're not in any way confused about who's winning the fight. And again, depending on the commission, we can do that. In Illinois, unfortunately, we can't broadcast it in the arena, but it does get broadcast on the screen, so the fighters don't get the benefit of it. But for the majority of our fights, fighters do know, and then you see that they've got to pick up the pace because they don't have a lot of time to work.
Okay, so that's an interesting one, because there's such a... To me, it's always been a big emotional thing about open scoring. You know, I've seen it talked about in boxing and in MMA for 20 years, and it never gets changed. And I always remember, you know, I would watch it in Japan, and I didn't see a negative in it. And I always think that, like, the one thing about the boxing and the MMA that I didn't like with the scoring is the sense of, if you're watching a baseball game or you're watching a football game or a basketball game, you know what the score is, the teams know what the score is, they know what they have to do, they adjust their strategy based on it. And in an MMA fight or in a boxing fight, it's a lot of guesswork. And sometimes you're right and sometimes you're wrong, and you know, even if like if you know, like, the people will get mad at a decision, at least they'll be able to see it coming, and the fighters will know, and whatever. So from your perspective, now that you're running shows with open scoring and also without open scoring, I mean, is there a positive of the scores being kept secret at all, or is it just tradition?
Well,
and then you got to deal with it?
Yeah, like, I can buy into the argument of being a traditionalist. The thing that is interesting about scoring is it's all perspective, and it's also subjective, that it's great for water cooler talk afterwards, you know, arguing about it. And so in some ways it keeps the conversation alive. But when it comes to, you know, the output that the fighters put in and what they commit to this, to have it stand in the hands of somebody's judgment is probably one of the more dissatisfying things, which is why, you know, the mantra of don't leave it to the hands of the judges. So by opening the scoring, you know, the attempt is, and, you know, we didn't invent this, as you mentioned, is going on in Japan, is the attempt is to try to ensure that the fighters, who are the ones putting in all the work, know exactly what these judges are thinking about them, so that they can take matters into their own hands. And sometimes they can change the course, and sometimes they can't, but at least they know. And so I'm all in favor of that, because these fighters work so hard. I think some of the things, when you talk to judges and regulators, that they don't love about it is that judges start to get swayed by looking at the judging of their colleagues. And if they see in a case of a 3-judge panel, or sometimes we use 5 judges, that every judge is different than them, The concern is it starts to get that judge who made his own independent call, he starts to change and adjust and wonder why he's different than everybody else. And so I get that. But again, because there's so much subjectivity, if we can find a way to level it out a little bit, I think that's better. It's better for the fans. And I know it's better for the fighters. Like, the fighters put just too much into this to leave it, you know, to the discretion of a judge. So we try to at least give them some of the information to help them adjust what they're doing.
So Chicago, what arena are you running in Chicago?
So we are in the Wintrust, which is the arena downtown. So it's first time we're there. You know, we scale it down. We'll probably have about 4,000 people in each one. So we, you know, set the production so that it's intimate for everybody that comes in. Obviously, as we're building here, so we're excited to be there. We've been in Chicago before, but in some of the arenas that are out more in the suburbs, and we've done well there, which is why we decided if there was one market where we could do back-to-back events and obviously, you know, sell tickets to a Friday and a Saturday night, Chicago was the one that made sense. It's a great fight town. We have a great Romanian fighter who's on a co-main. There's a big community there. So, you know, we're doing all the tricks we can to make sure that we speak to that market and activate there the right way.
Yeah, you're actually going head-to-head with WWE both nights.
Yeah, I know. That is what's really interesting about this space. I remember managing the pay-per-view calendar as one of my roles at In Demand, and it wasn't that often. Everyone, WWE went Sunday. You know, you had boxing going Saturday at the time. UFC was relegated to Fridays. We weren't permitting them to go Saturdays because we didn't want the conflict, and very rarely and memorably you would have a boxing event go up against each other on a Saturday, and the promoters would get their backs up, and we'd have to decide what event we're going to do. But now with all of these outlets and all this distribution, it's even though there are 52 weeks in a year or weekends in a year, it's just not every day is not the perfect day. So for us, you know, we sort of run our business and, you know, run our play, if you will, and hope that, you know, we draw our audience. But yeah, it's a very busy, and especially in this market around fight sports, there is just a lot of interest, which again is why we're fighting to make an impact here, because we know the audience exists.
As far as like the kickboxing, have you been able to like figure out, like, you know, Chicago seems to be this key market. Are there markets that, like, for whatever reason you've noticed, you know, besides Chicago are better than others, or others that would, for whatever reason, you work hard and it doesn't click? How much does like a hometown star help?
Yeah, hometown stars are very helpful for not only selling tickets, but really to activate the local media. You know, I'm a big believer, and this is something Lorenzo really preached, and I've always believed that he was right about this, is you've got to get other people talking about your product. You can't just be the only one talking about it. So those local fighters help activate the local media, and then they talk about the event. So that's critical for us. And to your question about, are there some markets that work and some don't? For sure, you know, even in the UFC, you would experience this. You know, there's some markets where there's just a lot going on, like a market like LA. You come here and there's just so much, whether it's basketball season or baseball season or the mountains or the beach or whatever it is. But what we found right now, and since I've been there, we started installing this, is we like to go to markets where there's fight activity happening, whether it's MMA or boxing, but primarily we go where there's MMA happening, or there are MMA gyms where people are training, because, you know, for us, if we can get MMA guys to come and check it out, and then they're, you know, on their social channel saying they're at the event, that really helps us. It also helps with awareness. You know, there's generally fighters coming from gyms associated with other fighters who may be fighting in other promotions. So we try to be really choosy about doing that. That doesn't always work, because we have certain weekends we're trying to run, and sometimes you can't get the right venue. So you know, if somebody were to see our event calendar option, their head would spin in terms of how many cities, how many venues we've got holds on, so that when we know what fight we can deliver, we're able to try to react to it. So For sure. Not different than boxing in that way. I think the UFC is a unique beast, and WWE the same. Their brands are so big, they could go into just about any market, you know, sell very well. But for us, you know, being where we are, we've got to be really choosy. But in Western Europe, you know, we could almost do an event anywhere from Paris to Berlin to Amsterdam and do well because the brand is so big and people know, you know, what they're going to get.
So as far as like Europe goes, you know, like what markets, like you mentioned, like, you know, Amsterdam, it was, I mean, even remember years and years ago, I mean, for whatever reason, like kickboxing was always big in Amsterdam. You know, that they, I'm, you know, like compared to like, you know, it was kind of like how, you know, wrestling is big in Iowa type of a thing. I don't even know why. Obviously, kickboxing was always big in Thailand, you know, forever and ever. But is there a reason like Amsterdam, you know, and is Holland still like the European Mecca? And is there a reason why Holland is like that, but maybe the UK isn't, or something like that?
Yeah, I asked the same question of our Dutch guys because we have an office in Amsterdam, and there was a sort of an exchange of sports cultures, if you will, between Thailand and Amsterdam and Netherlands for a while. There was a great Dutch fighter, Raymond Dekker, who was going into Thailand and beating all the best Thai fighters, which had never really happened. And so he became a hero in Amsterdam and in Thailand. And so there's just been this like close cultural relationship, whether it's people traveling there back and forth, which is why the Dutch scene grew so fast. And if you think about K1 and all the great Dutch fighters, and you still had Alistair Overeem, Dutch kickboxing is like Brazilian jiu-jitsu. Like, it is a thing. People train it from the time they're small, and they train it until the time they're big, and they become very big, successful fighters. But a lot of it started with the, you know, some of the Thai influence that came there, and people adapting it to sort of a Western boxing and taking some of the attributes of Muay Thai.
Okay, so again, want to make mention, so there's Friday and Saturday glory events from Chicago on Fight Pass, and then the big one December 21st, Rico Verhoeven and Bada Hari, which is, you know, that's the big, you know, Ollie Frazier of you know, this era of kickboxing. It's if you've never seen it and don't know who the two guys are, you know, probably you could look up, you know, YouTube clips and read about those two guys, but it's the real deal. And like I mentioned about Verhoeven, you'll be very, very impressed looking at clips of him and Bada Hari as well. You know, I mean, in the sense of and it's you know, is Bada Hari still like a villain type character, or is, because, you know,
yeah,
guys as they get older start as villains, end up being cheered, you know, like, you know, whether it's, you know, Jimmy Connors or you know, whatever, Tito Ortiz,
right.
You know what I mean? The guys that would get booed, when they get to be a certain age, people kind of start to
They mellow with age.
Right.
Yeah, well, they definitely mellow with age, fighters. And I think Bader, you know, has certainly had some of his controversy around him. But I think if you were to follow Bader on his social media now, you know, he's got a family, he's training hard, he's, you know, trying to keep that balance of being a fighter and a family guy. He's been very helpful on the promotion of this event, and, you know, doesn't have that sort of prima donna thing that sometimes comes with some of the, quote, bad boys of the sport. And having not worked with him in the past, it's hard for me to really say how he's changed. But, you know, for me and our, we just got a deal done with him earlier this year, another 3-year deal with him. So he's been great to work with, and I think he's probably shaken a lot of that, but there are still a lot of people who have that recollection of him, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. You know, Rico's very, you know, considered to be the clean fighter in terms of, like, you know, his social outreach and things like this, and Bader's carrying some of the past that you're speaking of. And so, you know, it's always good, you know, to have that sort of dichotomy in a fight.
Okay. And so I want to thank you, Marshall, for coming on and educating us all on this, you know, between kickboxing and just the landscape of just the whole changes in you know, trying to promote a new sport and trying to navigate the television aspect and then the pay aspect, pay versus streaming. It's kind of a, like, I consider this period like a real transitional period in combat sports culture, and then wrestling as part of that combat sports culture, with the, you know, the difficulty in starting something new, and the, you know, aversion of people to spend $50 on a show unless it's a giant show, but the ability to get, you know, I mean, all these different streaming services, and how many streaming services are you going to buy, which is just another aspect. It's like, you know, people will sometimes will complain about cable prices, but if you're like a fight fan, there's, you know, there's like with me, I can't even tell you how many subscriptions I have between DAZN and Stardom and New Japan World and WWE Network and Fight Pass, and I couldn't even tell you Dragon Gate and Revolution Pro and Progress. You know what I mean? It's like, whoa. It's insane.
It is a lot, you know. Yeah, when you have a passion, it is a lot. No doubt about it.
Yeah. So, but thanks, and good luck with these shows, and good luck with getting that breakthrough in the United States, and hoping that you know, like everyone, that Ronda Rousey walks through your door one day and it all changes.
That's a great line. Yeah, that's great. Well, thanks, David. It's good to speak with you again. You know, it's been a while since I've had a chance to chat with you, and so I really enjoyed this. I've always been impressed by your knowledge of the game, so, and I think there are a lot out there that feel the same way.